Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your health and well-being and the health of our total health environment. This means the health of your community, the health of the society, the health of the planet Earth, the health of our food, water, air, and all of the things that we need for life on this beautiful planet. And we also talk about science, public policy, the political system, cultural attitudes, the media, all the different things that go into affecting our understanding, our well-being, and the well-being of the body politic. So each week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different authors, experts, advocates, documentary filmmakers, thought leaders, activists, all kinds of different people. And today, I'm delighted to have with us someone who's been on the show multiple times before and is running for the Senate, the U.S. Senate in the state of Maryland. So delighted today that our guest is Margaret Flowers. She's the co-director of It's Our Economy, also has her own radio program calling Clearing the Fog Radio, and also runs, along with Kevin Zeef, the website and initiative Popular Resistance, as well as the advocacy group Flush the TPP, which is pretty obvious what that's about. Margaret is a pediatrician who graduated from the University of Maryland School of Medicine and completed a pediatric residency at Johns Hopkins Hospital. She left private practice in 2007 to advocate full-time for a single-payer healthcare system at both the state and national levels, and that's, in fact, where I first heard her and encountered her work, hearing her speak on the Bill Moyers program. As someone who is a longstanding health journalist myself, I report on everything concerning health, as you can tell by everything I say in the theme of the show, and that's how I came to advocacy, activism, and concern for the environment, which I cover nowadays a great deal. It really all came out of concern for health. So we share, although in different areas of expertise, this background of looking through the lens of health at the social choices we make. And that's one of the reasons it's so thrilling that Margaret Flowers is stepping up and running for Senate. So welcome back to Connect the Dots, Margaret.
Well, thank you for inviting me back.
We've never had the opportunity to do this on previous shows because I think most of your appearances on Connect the Dots have been in connection to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which has, it's been an area of strong activism for you over the last several years, and also very effective because when these conversations first began, it was very little known, and that was, in a sense, we've learned by design because the mainstream media kind of really doesn't cover this because it's a big agenda of the president and the corporatocracy. But nevertheless, it's never had a higher profile. We can certainly thank the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders for that, but a lot of the groundwork and the all of the phases of kind of seeding that ground and growing a community of concerned citizens around this issue really began prior to his campaign with a lot of the work that you, Kevin Zeef, and many others have been doing. But let's just back up a moment and talk about how, in your own life trajectory, from, seeking to and then becoming a physician, you crossed the, crossed the threshold, entered the political realm, and, what the trajectory has been that leads you now to this step of running as a Green Party candidate for the Senator of the state of Maryland.
Sure. Thank you, Allison. So I guess I came to, becoming a physician from kind of a non-traditional path. There's nobody in my family that's ever been in any health profession. But as, I was the youngest of five children and raised by a single mother and just really had a passion early in life for science and health and kind of just kept pursuing that. And I really, you know, I'd had a lot of experience caring for younger children and was very interested in developmental issues and kind of, you know, fostering healthy childhood. So pediatrics seemed like a real natural for me. And so it came into that really with the attitude of, this is great, I can use this knowledge, go out and practice and help families and children to really have a healthy start on life. And my feeling was, if you had a healthy start, that could last your whole life long. So that was my, you know, attitude going in, and then quickly ran into the reality of our healthcare system, which is that it's not about health. It's about making profit for private insurance companies, for hospitals, for pharmaceutical industries. And there are a lot of obstacles to actually getting the care that we need for our patients. Too often it's a conversation of, you know, what are you allowed to do? Where are you allowed to go? What are you allowed to have? How much can you afford? And that wasn't really with health in mind. So eventually, you know, after being in practice for a number of years and finding that, you know, all of us in the health professional practices are forced to spend less and less time with patients, more time on paperwork, more time fighting with insurance companies, and didn't feel like that was an environment in which I could really provide high quality care. So I started trying to do advocacy at the same time as I was practicing and also a mother of three children. And it felt like, you know, one of those areas had to give. And I decided to pursue advocacy because in addition to feeling like I needed to really throw myself into it, no longer being in practice meant that I had liberty to speak out in ways that I wouldn't feel comfortable if I was still practicing. A lot of my colleagues who continue to practice are somewhat hesitant to speak out about, you know, fighting for a national healthcare system because they worry about retaliation. And in fact, some of them have been retaliated against for doing that. Mm-hmm. So as you know, that led into a whole path of seeing the connections to so many other issues of, you know, it's not just about getting access to healthcare, but having a clean environment, reducing wealth inequality, good education, you know, place to live, good job. So my advocacy really broadened out, and numerous times people asked me if I would run for office, and I kept feeling that no, my role was more important on the outside, pushing from the outside, working on movement building. But then this opportunity came in Maryland, where our longtime Senator Barbara Mikulski is stepping down. It's an open seat. And I knew who was going to be running for that seat. And I felt like when I was asked, yes, this is the time to step up and run for that seat. And in addition to that, I'm also running to help build up the Green Party and build up that political power for progressive change that we need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting coincidence that both you and Jill Stein are physicians. It fascinates me because a lot of my work before I got into advocacy was in personal self-care, preventive medicine, proactive health care, so that, you know, people could take steps to eat right, live healthy lives, all of that. But increasingly, and I think all of those things, if you're in an economic group that can afford to do them and avail yourself of the healthiest foods and all of that, you know, are great. And I think as pioneering initiatives, they were great. But it always bothered me that they weren't made available to everybody, that, you know, having kind of put on one's own air mask in the airplane, you know, by eating healthy food, that people didn't go out and assure that that opportunity was available to everybody, you know, as well as understanding that the pollution, the contamination, indeed the very destruction of the earth, you know, is going to make the idea that an individual can, you know, do a health workaround not always that feasible or realistic, and more almost a coping mechanism for dealing with the increased dangers of our world, and that directly shifting public policy would be the way to go. And the reason I frame the question, you know, or this aspect of the conversation that way is because Progressive Radio was founded by Gary Null, and, you know, we do have a lot of health listeners. It's like they're also, he's also very far ahead of the curve, and there are a lot of advocates who have programs on the station as well. But I think the connection between our health and the choices that we make in our world is something that's sort of overlooked by health seekers. I mean, what is just, you know, how healthy is our society? How much do you feel that people really grasp what is essential for health? And I realize this is kind of a different tack on the issues, but you're uniquely qualified to address that, so I can't help but ask.
Well, I also wanted to address what you said at the beginning, that Jill Stein and I, both being doctors and, you know, pursuing politics. And I think that stems a lot from our training as physicians, that you're looking for the root causes of, you know, of the conditions that our patients are facing. And so when you look at, you know, so much of what's happening outside the office, you know, that is the root cause of what's driving people into the office. And we can keep medicating them or telling them to try to avoid these things or find healthy food if they can find it and afford it. But in reality, you know, it's hard to fight these things at that individual level. And I think that so much, so often in our society, people are told that it's their personal responsibility, it's their fault that they're not healthier. But we live in a society that does not in any way promote health. You know, industries are allowed to go out and pollute. So no matter how much you try to green your home and use, you know, low VOC paint and cleaning products that are not toxic, once you step outside the door, that's all moot. You know, same thing with our food supply. You know, so much of the food that is available or is affordable is low quality, heavily processed, GMO containing food. People are overworked. They don't have time for recreation or family time. We're not really educating, you know, our youth in a, you know, well-rounded way or providing them with, you know, adequate physical exercise, adequate time for art. So we just really don't live in a society that at all promotes health. And so it's really, to me, it seems unfair to try to put that burden on individuals. As much as there's nothing wrong with promoting, you know, people, educating them about healthy ways of living and encouraging exercise, but we have to recognize that our society doesn't really support that. And so that's why I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's really critical that we go out and shape public policy, because we can look around the world and find other countries that actually do use, you know, public policy to lift up and support their, you know, their residents, their citizens. And so we could do this. We could have clean, efficient transportation and communities that are walkable or bikeable so people can get out, you know, that way and reduce cars. We could have, you know, make available healthy produce and, you know, even just in our schools. If our school systems provided really healthy choices for food, we would see so much improvement in academic performance and behavior. This has been shown in places around the United States where they've done that. So there's a lot that we can do at the kind of policy level that would create a much healthier society.
And do you feel that people are tuning into that, ready to hear that message, fired up about this? You know, have you seen a process of awareness about these questions growing over the time that you've been engaged with it?
You know, I have, and especially I live in Baltimore, Maryland, which is a city of great inequality, really stark inequality. And, you know, you hear it from the youth in the communities that have not been invested in, that they would like to have healthy choices of food, but all they really have available are these corner stores. And it's much less expensive for them to grab a candy bar than to grab a healthy sandwich. So, you know, that's what they're driven towards. You know, it's hard to get fresh produce. People, you know, the people that I talk to, they want a good education. They want to have a job. They want to be able to contribute in positive ways in their community. And it's really, it's in some ways, it's just really devastating to see the lack of opportunities and the impact that it has on our youth in some of the communities in Baltimore. And they have such courage trying to continue, you know, persevering in that environment.
What are your goals in, you know, let's say, when you're elected senator, when you get the nomination, when you're elected. You know, actually, you don't need the nomination. You're already running in the Green Party
right.
line.
Right.
You know, what are your goals as senator? What would your goals be?
Mm-hmm. Well, the slogan for my campaign is "Let People Power Bloom," and it's really about helping people to understand how we build political power for progressive change. And my experience shows that, or tells me that we can't do this within one of the, you know, wealth-dominated parties, the Democrats or the Republicans. If we stay in those parties, we're really just giving permission for them to continue on the path that they've been on, and it's not in any way adequate. So by running as an alternative party, we're really building the power outside of that framework. So because I don't take any corporate or PAC money, and I will, you know, continue to not do that, once I'm elected, my focus is really going to be on working with, you know, popular movements to advance the agenda that we need to advance to address so much of the problems, the crises that we're facing in our society. Top ones for me would be, of course, healthcare. When I was working in Congress in 2009, 2010 during the health reform process to push for a national improved Medicare for All, I saw that with just a small amount of resources and working very strategically in a flexible way so that we could respond to the political winds, we were able to get a single payer amendment to the floor of the Senate in December of 2009. So I completely believe that we can create the political will to move that forward. And that's a first step for me in terms of removing the profit motive from our health and making our healthcare system about health. And then there's a lot that we need to do beyond that. But that's a critical first step. So I'll be pushing strongly for a national improved Medicare for All health system. I also think the climate crisis is another one that we have to address urgently. And I support the call for a Green New Deal or a kind of a major mobilization in a comprehensive way with clear goals to deal with the climate crisis. So it means we have to say, you know, we're going to become 100% renewable at this certain date, whether it's 2025 or 2030, you know, whatever we can is possible. But it also means dealing with our agricultural system and making sure that we're using more regenerative agricultural practices that build up the carbon in the soil. They sequester carbon and also improve the nutrition of our food. But it's also about making clean, efficient, rapid transit, and making our homes and buildings carbon neutral. So we really have to have a comprehensive plan for that. And then the other, I think, major priority for me is ending poverty, dealing with the economy. So I've been promoting a guaranteed basic income, which would end poverty immediately. We need to rein in Wall Street and make them accountable. We need to find the revenue through taxing wealth in a more progressive way, and then use that to invest in community, local economies that serve the public good. So those are some of my major priorities.
Yeah, that's really a terrific list. I recently circulated an article or two articles. One is the percentage of American children who are living in poverty is really a I mean, we talked somewhat about some other issues, but I was just really shocked and appalled that we could have a wealthy nation with so many people financially benefiting and then, you know, have so many millions of children living in poverty. And I just don't know how we can hold our heads up with that kind of thing going on. And in addition, children are being incarcerated. If children of poverty are being incarcerated, if their parents go to prison and the family doesn't have the money to sustain the children in being in some kind of care facility, then they just put them in jail. You know, who does this? I mean, it's just, you can't use the word democracy at all, you know, if you're doing that kind of, if that kind of thing is going on. Now, let me ask you, I mean, is there, you know, people would say, for example, I can just kind of hear it, if there's an effort to tax the wealthy in order to redress some of this and provide some guaranteed income, which our nation could afford if our priorities were different, you know, what kind of obstacles and how would you overcome the obstacles that people will inevitably point, to the Republicans, you know, in Congress, in terms of, oh, they will never let that through. You know, once they dominate, nothing like this could ever happen. It's unrealistic. At the same time, when we've watched, as we have, you have, and I have on this show with our listeners, you know, how it's gone down with the TPP and the Democrats, who have also participated in this big global power grab. You know, that side of the aisle is as you say, they're both wealth-driven parties. How, you know, what kind of scenario would you see for yourself and other progressives elected to Congress and the Senate to get, you know, for example, that kind of bill passed, you know, to a progressive tax bill of some kind?
Right, right. And I just quickly wanted to address what you said about kind of the prison situation, because when I was out in Seattle, Washington last year, I learned that they were using third grade testing in the schools to determine and to predict how many youth were going to be sent to detention centers down the road. So instead of, you know, looking at those third grade testing results and saying, wow, we need to actually address what's going on here and make sure that our students are succeeding, they instead invested millions of dollars in expanding the beds in the youth detention center. So this is just outrageous to me that this is the approach that would be taken in this country. Anyway, in terms of, you know, passing a progressive agenda, look, every solution that we're putting forward, first of all, has majority support in the population. Mm-hmm. And so it's a matter of people recognizing that we have the power to make these things happen if we use it, and if we use it strategically. We're constantly told that you have to compromise, and I see that, you know, people are told, well, politics is all a game of compromise. Gandhi said you can't compromise on fundamentals because it's all give and no take. And that's what we have to recognize, that these things we're talking about are fundamental changes that need to happen so that we can have a healthy and prosperous society. And that it is up to us as people to change the political wind, to change the political culture, to make sure that they happen. Everything that we're fighting for is a battle, but everything that's worth fighting for, you know, is going to be a struggle. So we have seen, we saw it through the net neutrality fight when we were told that reclassification of the internet was off the table, you know, that no way we'd be going up against giant telecoms, the biggest lobbyists in Washington, D.C. But when we fought back and worked strategically to get it on the table and then got millions of people commenting and continuing to push throughout that whole time period, we were able to get the internet reclassified and protect net neutrality. We, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, when we started this 5 years ago and there was a media blackout and it seemed like an impossible job to go up against these giant transnational corporations, but the people have done it. We've joined together through a movement of movements, and people have, you know, brought their skills and their talents to this struggle, and we've pushed this into an election year and made it an election issue. And now, you know, we have the possibility of winning this, of defeating this terrible agreement. So these are all lessons that empower people in how we actually can create social change, and that's the history of our country. Every great change that we have made has come from a strong social movement and alternative parties that reflected the values of that movement. And so that's why I feel like I've been fighting this fight on the outside, and if I can get inside and become the U.S. Senator for the state of Maryland, this will provide another door, another opportunity for the movement to come into that realm and push for the changes that we need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds fantastic. What has been the response in Maryland as you have campaigned? Is your message resonating with people? Like, what, you know, what's been going on in your actual campaign?
Thanks. Yeah, it's been really exciting. You know, so the major media outlets refuse to cover me. It's almost a joke now. I call them up and they make up new excuses all the time about why they won't cover my race, but my opponents can practically sneeze and they get an article about them. So we've been using a lot of social media and have been now recognized as the campaign with the fastest growing social media presence. We're getting out around the state. We have volunteer teams all over the state that do visibility and flyering and tabling events. And we're constantly getting new volunteers and new people excited about the campaign all the time. The message is absolutely resonating with people. And they're so hungry for truth, for hope, for a real alternative. They understand the corruption of our political process. So it's really been very exciting. You know, it is a challenge, but at the same time, it's just really exciting to see how people are inspired by the campaign. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons I think that the Democrats have been doing so poorly in Maryland is that they don't inspire anybody. They're just, you know, the same compromisers, the same old ideas, and people are getting tired of that in this state.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Barbara Mikulski was an interesting figure for her time because she was a sort of true old-fashioned liberal in the best sense, as well as having a kind of few weak areas. So it's kind of interesting. And also one of the, you know, kind of first in the door Senate women senators, mm-hmm. you know, so it is an mm-hmm. interesting seat as a breakthrough seat. Would you care to say a few words about the opposition, who your opponents are in the race?
Sure. So the Republican candidate is a woman named Kathy Shalega. She comes from Baltimore County and she's a state delegate. Mm-hmm. And she's, you know, running kind of a traditional Republican platform. Democratic opponent is Chris Van Hollen. He's a member of Congress from the 8th Congressional District in Maryland. And he is, you know, I think of him as a Clinton type of Democrat. He's very much connected to Wall Street, you know, wealth. He was the former head of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which raises money for the House Democrat campaigns. And so in his position as head of that body, he was really the person who went to the Wall Street funders to get the money and then distributed that to the House Democrats. And so he's raised almost $10 million for his Senate run this year, which is just really, it's, you know, that's a huge amount of money. And it's mostly coming from K Street lobbyists, developers, and financial institutions. So that kind of gives you a sense of who he is. He's been a really, you know, kind of mainstream Democrat, although he has a progressive veneer in terms of the positions that he's taken. He's never really tried to fight for the real changes that we need. He's never stepped outside of what he's allowed to do within that kind of Democratic Party. And that's why I think it's so important that we challenge him, because this is a time when we can't afford to just kind of maintain the status quo or tweak the status quo. We really have to get in there with clear solutions and fight for them and put them into place. Because, like I said earlier, every crisis that we're facing has solutions, and majorities of people in the United States support those solutions. So it's just a matter of us recognizing our power and making them a reality.
Mm-hmm. So actually, it's really an empowering kind of message as opposed to, you know, sort of, I mean, there's a sense of empowerment in the Clinton campaign, for example, with the notion that women will be helped to rise up through the glass ceiling. I mean, that is supposed to be empowering, but it's kind of vertical empowerment, and there are people who, you know, still buy into the notion, Republicans as well as Democrats, you know, if I have a wealthy business person, then they'll help me economically, you know. You know, so it sounds like your opponent falls into that category. Are people buying that? And, you know, are they still believing that? You know, we see that some still are. What do you tell people about that who are maybe at the introductory level to waking up around what that way of thinking and what that way of governing has led us to?
Yeah, and I have had some interesting conversations and have seen kind of that light bulb go on in some of the people that I'm talking with, because, you know, there is so much this kind of indoctrination, you know, in Maryland is a strongly blue state, and People think that we're a progressive state, and you know, we've taken some tiny progressive steps, but we haven't really dealt with some of the really great crises that we're facing. So, you know, when people say, well, you know, you look at the ability to raise money as in order to have these connections as a form of power, I say, well, what is that power going to be used for? Is it going to be used for your benefit? You know, who's going to benefit? And clearly, that kind of a power, that agenda that he's pursuing is not an agenda that's going to be lifting all of us up. And, you know, in fact, I remember during the fight for single payer, when I talked to him personally, he had no knowledge of what single payer was or any interest in it at all. He did not co-sponsor the legislation. And now, of course, because I'm running, he's changed the language on his website and said, well, he supports a public option as a path to single payer, not recognizing that it's not in any way a path to single payer. But, you know, it's really about what kind of a change do you want? And so if you want change that's going to benefit all people, I use a human rights perspective in my approach because that is, and it is just shown to be the most effective approach. The principles of human rights are, the first two principles are universality and equity. So when we decide on a healthcare system, it has to be for everyone, and it has to be done in an equitable way so that everyone can have the same level of care. You know, if we look at education, it needs to be universal. It needs to be equitable as well. And right now I'm reading a book about Finland because they have the best education system in the world, and they made a commitment to this decades ago. They were facing exactly the same problems that we're facing right now in the United States, and it was hurting them, and instead they decided to create a strong, universal public education system with career teachers who are, you know, have a high level of education themselves and are empowered to teach, and it's worked. They've lifted up their population through a strong educational system, and we can do the same thing.
So it's like the solutions are out there, is what I hear you saying, but this huge problem of wealthy people taking corporate money and then sort of cycling it back into the kinds of old solutions that don't work, that support
right.
various industries, is really
right.
creating a block toward, you know, what the people really want. And so it's kind of how do we intervene and break out of that is really the challenge. Is what I hear you describing.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit why we didn't get single payer to begin with for people who, like your opponent, don't even understand what happened there?
Sure. And, you know, there are academic studies now, it's interesting, which show that our political system does serve the wealthy interests. There's been a number of them, but one that looked at 20 years of policy and found that it overwhelmingly benefited the interests of the wealthy as opposed to the interests and needs of the rest of the population. So that's what we're facing. We're facing a political system that's dominated by money, and it works for money. So the single payer fight was really interesting because when we saw it coming to a national level and, you know, knew that was going to happen, and I was very involved at the state level fighting for single payer at that time. And Maryland, of course, is very close to Washington, D.C. So we saw that there was kind of some of the, like, nonprofit health groups after the Massachusetts model was passed by Mitt Romney in 2006, and that was really a template for the national bill, the Affordable Care Act. We saw at the state level these nonprofit groups starting to push the Massachusetts model at the state level. And that model is expanding Medicaid, and then for anybody who doesn't qualify for Medicaid or Medicare, they would be forced to purchase private insurance with taxpayer dollars being used to subsidize that. And so we knew what was happening in Massachusetts. It, you know, it wasn't solving the problem. There continued to be people who are uninsured, people who couldn't afford to get health care. The premiums were still high. It was hard to afford insurance. So we didn't see that as a national model, but that's what was being pushed out there by these nonprofits. And then, in fact, in July of 2008, an organization was created called Healthcare for America Now, which is It's interesting because this often happens. So there's been an organization around for a long time called Healthcare Now, which is the grassroots single-payer movement. And so they used a name very similar to that to cause confusion. So Healthcare for America Now was funded with tens of millions of dollars, and it was really brought together all these so-called progressive organizations to rally around the legislation that was going to be put forth by the Democrats. And they floated out this idea of a public option, which is a public insurance that people could, you know, theoretically choose, and that this was going to compete with the private insurance. And they put out this whole notion that this would be a road, because it's going to be so much better than private insurance, that it would expand and become a single payer system. Well, it just doesn't work that way, and it hasn't worked that way when that's been tried at the state level. What happens is that the private insurers continue to cherry pick off the healthiest population, and the public insurance ends up with the sicker population, has a higher burden of costs, and so either has to cut back on who they cover or what they cover, or just eventually goes bankrupt. So it's just throwing one more insurance into the mix when one of our major problems right now is that we have all these different insurance, you know, companies and plans, and segregating our risk pools so that we can't really, you know, kind of create the big risk pool that we need, where everybody throws their money in and there's enough to cover people that are sick when they need it. And you know, we have such a heavily bureaucratic medical system. Over a third of our healthcare dollars just go to paperwork because of all these different plans. And, you know, patients have to deal with them. Health professionals have to deal with them. The insurance companies have a tremendous amount of paperwork. All that gets cut down significantly if we move to a single payer or an improved Medicare for All system. So we saw this kind of, you know, control over the progressive groups, this kind of manipulating people. Because what was interesting at the time, that 80% of Democratic constituents supported single payer, and over 60% of the general public supported single payer. So they had to really kind of derail that support, and the message that people were being told is, you can't have single payer, it's too much, this is a step towards single payer, we have to compromise because this is all we can get. And so we didn't accept that. But it really did divide the movement and caused a lot of conflict within people that wanted health reform, that wanted real change. And so, and that's a common tactic, is to divide a movement because then you weaken it. So it was interesting to me that those of us who continued to hold strong for a single payer and push for it, that we in fact were able to get almost get a single payer resolution to the floor of the House. It would have replaced the House health bill with a single payer bill. And then we were successful in getting a single payer amendment to the floor of the Senate. It was killed using, you know, there was actually a doctor from Oklahoma, I think his name is Corbine or something like that, who actually used a parliamentary move to require that the amendment be read on the floor, and it was an 800-page amendment, and this was in a time when there was a tremendous pressure. It was right before the winter break, and there was tremendous pressure on the Senate to get their bill out of committee or, you know, off the floor. And so Senator Sanders, who introduced that amendment, made a deal with Harry Reid that he would get a half-hour floor speech if he agreed to pull that amendment. But it was, you know, it was the first time in the history of the U.S. that we got a single-payer bill to the floor of either of the bodies. So you know, why we didn't get single-payer was because people gave up their power. And the nonprofits that, you know, whose constituents wanted single payer and should have been representing them were being controlled by the money. And literally it came out afterwards that Jim Messina, who was President Obama's campaign chair in 2012, but prior to that was his staffer in the White House, that his role was kind of the enforcer. He would meet with the nonprofit progressive groups every Tuesday, and he would bring their funders, and he would say, here's what you're allowed to say, here's what you're allowed to advocate for, and if you don't do that, you're going to lose your funding. And so, and all the Democrats were being controlled. They had to stay on certain talking points. They were given their talking points. And even as the bill got weaker and weaker, many of the Democrats that I knew, who knew better, who understood what single payer was, just said, this is all about the president's legacy. This is all about, you know, the midterm elections. We have to hold our nose and vote for this legislation. And Dennis Kucinich, who was the final holdout, who was opposing the Affordable Care Act, was taken on an airplane ride with the president and basically told that this is going to, if this bill doesn't succeed, it's all going to be on your shoulders. And of course, even though he changed his position and supported it, he was then removed. You know, they redistricted his district. They gave Marcy Kaptur, became his challenger, and she was given tremendous amounts of corporate money, and he lost his seat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, you know, what happened in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I've never heard such a complete telling of this. I mean, that really is fascinating, and it kind of makes sense. And so out of that, you know, you spoke earlier about, you know, the idea that you have to compromise is actually a politics of forcing people, you know, of compromised people, forcing people where the people elected in by the voters are kind of tossed out the door if they don't compromise with this way of functioning, I mean, is what you're describing
right.
in a nutshell. So the compromise
right.
is not like, instead, ironically, some, you know, liberals have internalized the message, we must compromise, and are actually enabling and repeating the very same thing that's the problem. How incredibly
right.
ironic.
Right.
That is a really important tale to tell because, you know, let's just talk a little bit about, you know, language like it's the president's legacy, which is, of course, they're saying the same, exactly the same as the TPP. I never heard
yes.
of a president enforcing their legacy before. You know, your legacy is whatever you did, and then later people look back on it.
Right.
You know, what is the wake-up call, and what is it that people can best do when there is this repeated and very savvy attempt to split movements? We have that right now with people,
mm-hmm.
for example, on the presidential level, wanting to
mm-hmm.
vote against Trump, but afraid to vote for a candidate like Jill Stein that, you know, some are, that, you know, that is very close, even Bernie supporters. You know, instead of everyone uniting and winning by joining with others of like mind, instead we're prone for this fragmentation to occur.
Yeah.
How do we communicate about that? How can people heal that, wake up to it, you know, because that seems to be a big story here.
Yeah, well, it's a fundamental tactic. It's been used throughout time. That's how power operates. They divide their opposition and weaken it. And so we have to recognize that that's what is happening. You know, I look at a couple of points on that. One, when I came out of the single-payer fight in Congress, the kind of lessons that I learned from that we needed to think about and going forward actually fit into the acronym ICU, which so I started saying, well, you know, we're in a healthcare crisis, we need the ICU. And the I stands for independence. We have to make sure that our agenda is independent of a political party's agenda. We can't tie it to that health bill. Should not have been about the president's legacy. That health bill should have been about the population's health. And by tying it to the Democratic Party agenda and the president's legacy, we got something that isn't working. So independence is critical. Clarity is also critical. People have to understand what it is that is going to fix the problem and what isn't. So that whole public option that people were fooled with and told was a solution. And in reality, in March of 2009, I was at the Center for American Progress when Senator Baucus, who was the head of the Senate Finance Committee, spoke. And he admitted back then that it was a bargaining chip, that it was never meant to be in the final legislation. So people were not only being fooled with a false policy, but it was a policy that was not even going to make it into the final bill. So people need to have clarity. They have to look beyond the political rhetoric and educate themselves about what is and isn't going to work. And then the final is to be uncompromising. You know, when we're told that we have to compromise, we're basically being told, give up your power. And nobody ever won. You know, we didn't win the abolition of slavery or, you know, the 40-hour work week or women's rights by compromising. We won that by staying. You know, we've always been told we're asking for too much. But what we're asking for is what we need, and that's not too much. And so we have to stay true to that. So the ICU is kind of an acronym that people can remember. Also, you know, one of the biggest myths that's been told since the Green presidential candidate Ralph Nader in 2000 is that, you know, third parties are spoilers and they're the ones that are, you know, ruining things and they're going to create, you know, this worse situation, this terrible person is going to get in if you vote for them. The reality is Nader didn't spoil the 2000 election if you look at the facts, but even if he had, that would have been political power. That would have shown the parties, hey, you're on the wrong track here. You're losing your voters because you're not representing them or their interests, and you better get in shape. Instead, what the lesson they took was Ralph Nader, you know, was a spoiler, and they continued running the same kinds of militarist, you know, neoliberal corporate Democrats as they continue to run today. No politician has a right to your vote. You as a voter are the one who has a right to decide whom you're going to vote for, and you're not taking a vote away from someone else because you vote for their opponent. You have a right to decide, and the politicians have to earn your vote. And so I think with this dominant narrative that we've had now for a long time of, you know, hold your nose and vote for the lesser evil has driven a race to the bottom in our presidential candidates. And now we have two of the most disliked presidential candidates in history. Both of them. So that tells us we need to break out of this cycle and start voting for what we want instead. Even if we lose the election this year, we have to continue to build that power. That's how it's happened throughout history. And eventually we will win, but we don't win by voting for what we don't want.
Let me ask the inevitable but horrible question. I hate to ask this question, but I know that it's in people's minds. When you say even if we lose, it means even if Green candidates don't win, we're still building party strength.
I
totally agree with that. You know, I don't live in a swing state, so I don't really, you know, I know what I can do, and other people can arrive at their own conclusions. But what do you say to the, you know, the panic over what about Trump? Wouldn't it be so much worse if this individual comes in? You know, I mean, and, you know, as you kind of, you know, be very curious what you think about that. But the other thing that does occur to me is that one often feels that, you know, the candidates either get bought or potentially even threatened. I was looking at a video clip of John F. Kennedy kind of calling out the way that all this works together back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was assassinated, and you know, I don't. That falls in the realm of conspiracy for people who, you know, kind of have just been swimming in the middle of the mainstream. But you know, it is a question that sometimes people have: what's going on here? Is it really possible for you know, a true blue candidate to break through this deadlock? You know, and what would happen, you know, if somebody like Trump were in? Would it be much, much worse? Or do we even know, given the kind of confusion over, you know, what he really stands for in the way of policy?
Right. So, first off, every presidential election cycle, this fear-mongering is used, and it's used on both sides. So the Democratic voters are being told that Trump is the scariest and most awful thing, and the world will end if he's elected. And the Republicans are being told Hillary Clinton is the worst, most awful thing, and everything will end if she's elected. So we have to step back and break out of that and recognize that both of them are, I think this year we don't have a lesser evil. I think we have two greater evils because, you know, Trump is awful in his racism, but at the same time, he wouldn't be a very strong president if he won because his own party doesn't even like him. And at least one thing that members of Congress who are Democrats do have is that when the opposite party is in power in the presidency, they do tend to have a little bit more spine and stand up to them than they do when it's someone of their own party. If Hillary Clinton is elected, we know what she's going to do. We know that she's going to continue economic policies that favor the wealthy interests, that we're going to continue to undermine our health care and our education and our, you know, jobs and worker rights. We know that she's going to continue a very militaristic policy, that she's going to continue to pursue aggression towards Russia. She's very belligerent towards Russia. You know, she was responsible for the coup in Honduras, you know, for helping that to happen, for the attack on Libya. And so these, you know, this is not, I think they're both in their own ways, and she will be a strong president. She will be able to push her agenda forward. So I think both of them are very concerning, and we need to step out of that politics of fear and just recognize that we're on a pretty serious bad track here in the United States, and we have to turn that around. We got to put the brakes on it, and that means building our power outside of those two parties.
And so what exactly, like in your state, for example, like you're running to win, I'm sure, but what percentage of the vote would be meaningful in terms of advancing the Green Party in your state?
Well, I think, you know, I'm trying to think what's the highest percentage that we've had in a race in Maryland at, you know, like a statewide level like this, and it's been pretty low, maybe like 2%. So, you know, I would love to go beyond that, and I feel confident that I will. And building up our party in terms of more people joining the party, that's happening, building up our infrastructure so that we have, and we're doing that as well, forming more local chapters, getting, you know, our statewide database together that candidates can use, kind of getting those structures in place to help candidates, doing trainings and things like that. So all of that's happening. So, you know, no matter what happens, I feel like this race is successful. But yes, I'm definitely running to win. And then a four-way race, that's not impossible.
Well, that's terrific. I hope that really happens. Let's talk a little bit about the TPP and climate. I mean, we've covered it a great deal on the show. But, you know, right now we have the Dakota Access Pipeline. Blockade is occurring. Both the main presidential candidates have, you know, failed to comment on it. Jill Stein was just there on site. The president is obfuscating and not saying anything. A group of Tufts were sent with dogs and mace to bulldoze a sacred site and attack the unarmed and peaceful demonstrators there. Where are we? Both, you know, this has something which has repercussions throughout four states in terms of its contamination effects in water aquifers, in people's lands, people's sacred lands that they had deeded access to. This is just overrunning it to produce Bakken oil, largely for export. So there really is no right-of-way provision that really stands for a, you know, a corporation coming in and, you know, rampaging through four states in order to, you know, produce and transport a product destined for abroad. Here we have one of the strongest, largest, peaceful, dignified protests that we you know, have seen in quite a long time and quite protracted. It's going on and on. And also, if this horrible pipeline goes forward, it has terrible implications for climate and for all of us. You know, what is your view and assessment of the potential of that activity to make a substantive shift? Of course, it's occurring largely in a media blackout. But what is this expressing? What's going on? What is it teaching us for moving forward? You know, what is your view of that?
Thank you. And I think it's really tremendous and has actually been going on for quite a while. I remember some of the members of the Standing Rock Sioux reaching out to us at Popular Resistance. And it may have been 2014 when they did. I know that, you know, it's been a while that they've kind of had that camp in a low level going on. And now it's great to see that finally taking off. And I think, you know, almost 200 tribes now are part of that effort. People all across the country are doing solidarity actions this week and next week with them. You know, thousands of people are coming out there. And I do think that will have an impact. And then they're doing exactly what needs to be done. They're modeling for others what we need to do, which is to understand the connections between our issues, to stand up together, to recognize the history of this country, which we don't talk about enough, the American genocide, which was what our country was founded on and which continues today through structural policies, and we need to end that. And showing true courage and nonviolent discipline to stand up to these corporate interests. I think it's tremendous, and I hope that it continues to grow, and that, you know, it, like the Keystone XL pipeline fight, that was able to, you know, succeed in having the permit for the northern leg of that denied, you know, I hope that they are able to be successful in this fight. There's all across the country these fights are going on, and we've been involved in some of them and have a very similar fight going on here in southern Maryland with a fracked gas refinery and export terminal that's being built in a residential community where it shouldn't be, and we don't need it anyway. So I think that, you know, the solidarity, the political awareness and understanding that our history continues to happen, you know, those same things are happening today, and showing this great courage is tremendous, and I hope it will have an impact. And why is the TPP important? The TPP is going to empower these corporations to even more to be able to prevent us from protecting our communities, just like we're seeing in the Keystone XL, you know, pipeline fight where President Obama was forced to deny the permit. Now TransCanada is suing the United States through a trade tribunal for $15 billion.
This is, I mean, one of the things that I wonder about, you know, is, to me, the biggest thing about the TPP, beyond the horrors of its environmental impacts, you know, spreading all of this fossil fuel, excavating the worst kind, the most damaging kind, spreading it all over the world, you know, it's going to put us over the climate precipice. I have an article about this now up on TrueStig, in fact, for any listeners who would like to go to TrueStig and read a full analysis of the Clinton energy plan on this topic and then what fracking worldwide would do, which is what the TPP, fracking, Bakken oil, all of it, offshore drilling, is all what the TPP would put into gear. And there's also new studies about this connecting the two. So obviously, with the TPP, climate is a huge concern. But the other thing is, almost any local action that you want to do, whether it's collecting seeds for your garden, selling products at your farmer's market, getting things from your farmer's market, any local activity, like very often, you know, we know that a lot of action begins at the grassroots when it happens in your community. You know, then people get the wake-up call, they stand up. I call it the draft, you know. Mm-hmm. It's what happened to me. It's what happened to a lot of us. Of course, some people don't hear the draft. They live, you know, 15 minutes, as I know people who do, from a nuclear power plant with a gas pipeline coming through it, and they're so-called environmentalists, and they just kind of tune it out. But for the people who hear the call, the solution is often proposed to be at the local level, and that has always held true and been good, and, you know, that's where the grassroots comes from. At the same time, if we allow these overarching superseding laws to come in on the national and global level, they would have a terrible chilling effect on the local level that I think people have trouble imagining. How do you see that?
That's, I mean, that's been a struggle for us as well, as to getting people who are, you know, rightly very focused on what's going on right in their own community, to understand that that work will be stopped, prevented from moving forward, and actually pushed backwards if we don't keep our eye on what's happening at the national and international level. And people are getting that, and there is a tremendous movement towards stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But I do want to make the point that what's happening with the No Dakota Access Pipeline, activity is also what we need to do around the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because, as you know, the president has notified Congress of his intention to ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership this year. That's likely to happen, you know, to be attempted after the election, because it's such an unpopular, issue with voters that everybody's running away from it right now. All of the candidates and members of Congress are saying, you know, either that they don't like it or they're not sure about it. That's going to change as soon as the election is over, and it's all going to become about President Obama's legacy again, or what the corporations want. So we are going to have to rise up and resist that in a very powerful way, and we can succeed if we do that, because we have before. We've stopped two of these major agreements in the past, the multilateral agreement on investments and the free trade area of the Americas with stopped through popular pressure. And so yesterday was Congress's first full day back in session after their summer break. We held a protest down there. We delivered letters to all the congressional leadership telling them, putting them on notice, the people's notice, that we're going to do everything within our power to prevent ratification of this agreement. We have an effort called the No Lame Duck, and we encourage people to go to flushthetpp.org/no-lame-duck and sign up, because if the lame duck is moving forward, we're going to be there with, you know, doing direct action and everything that we can to build that pressure to stop it. We have to. This is really a fundamental one for all of us.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a great way to end our wonderful hour with you, Margaret Flowers, candidate for Senate in the state of Maryland and the Green Party line. Thank you. And do participate by going to Flush the TPP for action against these horrible trade deals. If you are a resident of the state of Maryland, you can vote for Margaret Flowers on the Green Party line for senator. And between now and that opportunity, you can also participate in her social media, work with her campaign, help build out a grassroots in the state of Maryland, which is what this all opens up for people. Thank you so much, Margaret. What's your website for your Senate campaign for people who want to find you?
Thank you. It's an easy one. It's flowersforsenate.org. And thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I appreciate the work that you do.
Thank you so much, Margaret. And it's great supporting what you do and working, you know, on all these efforts. And everyone can join in, and I hope you will, listeners. So thank you, everyone, for being with us today on Connect the Dots. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well.